All right, welcome to Strong Words with Ian Strong, the entertaining entertainment podcast. I'm your host, Ian Strong, and thank you so much for joining me for a great episode that I have lined up for you with an actress, an author, a podcaster. She may not be a household name, but I guarantee you've seen something that she's been in, like possibly the movie Jarhead with Jake Gyllenhaal, or episodes of CSI, NCIS Los Angeles, True Blood, Lucifer, Six on the History Channel. She's also the host of the Secret Life podcast, which you can find anywhere you get your podcasts. And she's also written a new book, Secret Life of a Hollywood Sex and Love Addict, a novel. I'm talking to Breanne Davis today, and what a conversation that we had. We talk a little bit about her, where she's from, why she moved to Los Angeles, and booking her very first acting gig on Dawson's Creek, what it's like to work on a television show either as a recurring character or as a special guest, what her standards are for doing nudity on film before we spend some time talking about her 10-year recovery as a love and sex addict, defining what that means, and how her recovery has inspired her to want to help people tell their stories and unburden themselves of their guilt with her Secret Life podcast and with her new book. And after my interview with Breanne, stay tuned because I have a huge announcement about a future guest that I'm going to have right here on the show. Some of you may already know who it is because I'm so excited about it, but I'll tell you who it is and when you can expect to hear that interview. But let's get into my conversation with Breanne Davis right here on Strong Words with Ian Strong after I do what I do every episode, and that's transition in with a little bit of music that I personally recorded every instrument for just for you. So let's just jump in here. First of all, thanks for agreeing to be on my show. I'm really excited. I've been excited ever since we connected via Instagram to get together to do this. There's so much to talk about, so much to break down. You're an actress, you're a writer, you're a podcaster. And just to jump in here, I want to talk a little bit about everything that I just said because there's so much in there. But first, I just want to learn a little bit more about you. Like, where are you from originally?
Oh, I love that question. So I am actually from Houston, Texas. I was born in Texas, but I was raised in Hot Atlanta, Georgia.
I love Atlanta.
Oh, Atlanta's great. I mean, it's better now than it was when I was growing up. There's more culture, and I love it now more than when I grew up.
So you're originally from Atlanta, but you say you're from Houston. Where are you based out of today?
Los Angeles.
when did you move out there?
Oh my God. I try to guess because I have this with my addiction and my disease. I tend to like times and places I get mixed up because I'm never truly present. So I'll just say that. But I probably have been here almost 20 years, I would guess. 20 years? Yeah.
Okay.
Probably.
And was your primary reason for moving out there to pursue a career in acting?
Yes, that's why. I actually wouldn't live in this city if I wasn't an actor because it's home now, but it took a long time for me to feel like this was home.
Why is that?
Well, when you get here, and if you're interested in coming to LA, if you're listening and it's like a dream of yours, you have to prepare yourself. It's really hard to find good groups of people because we're all here. Most people are for a selfish reason, and you have to be very selfish to get into the entertainment industry, I think, definitely to start. So you can't really find like people to support each other because we're all kind of so driven about our own career. Mm-hmm. But once you establish yourself, you start meeting other people that are like supportive, and it just took a while, and everybody's like coming and going too. So it feels so unstable sometimes.
Yeah. Cause essentially you're basically going to a place where it's a very competitive environment. You got 10 million people living in a city where jobs only pop up about 30 at a time.
Correct. And as a woman too, if you watch any movie, most of the roles are males. So mm-hmm. it'd be like every five men, there's one woman role.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was the first role that you ended up booking?
Well, I actually booked a role before I came out to Hollywood. I mean,
who does that?
Well, that's how I figured out I wanted to be an actress. I never grew up wanting to be anything really, except maybe like a model. But I'm only 5'7". I'm not 5'8". So I knew it wasn't practical.
Is that one inch a big difference?
Oh my God, it is. It's like really? Oh gosh, yes. Unless you're Kate Moss. I mean, she's the only 5'7 model. Everybody else, I mean, Instagram models now can be shorter, but definitely when I started, you had to be 5'8", 5'9", at least. But my point is, I was modeling in Atlanta and I had a commercial agent and I was making money there. And they had this audition for Dawson's Creek that was in Wilmington. And I was like, oh, maybe I should try that. And I'm dyslexic and I have ADHD, but I just got like inspired to put myself out there. And they sent me the audition. I had to drive up to Wilmington because at that time you couldn't put yourself on tape for things. Mm-hmm. So I drove all the way to Wilmington, auditioned, drove all the way back to Atlanta, which is like 6.5 hours. And then 2 days later, I got the call back and I had to drive all the way back for the producer session. And then turn around and drive all the way back because I didn't have money to get a hotel or anything. Sure. So I was really happy when I got that part.
Well, what's it like going into an experience like that on a show that has, I assume, has already been on for a couple of seasons? But like, when, how long was that show on before you made your appearance?
I think it was 4 seasons or 5 seasons. Yeah. I was in the last season. And I was in 2 episodes. I was the hot assistant, Ashley. That was literally my name. They couldn't give me a last name or just make it Ashley.
I saw that. I saw that as your credit on your IMDb page. I was like, is that really what they called her? But that's what they call people like that all the time.
I know. And it's kind of embarrassing, but it's kind of a funny story, too.
Do you consider that to be embarrassing today or was it more so back then?
I think I'd consider it embarrassing in general. I wish it would have just been Ashley because I don't think like the hot girl Ashley helps the role, mm-hmm. you know? So I mean, listen, we start where we start. We take the roles we can get or we're cast in. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think it was always just a little like I just said her name was Ashley. And I think I actually put Ashley on IMDb and they switched it back. I've never told anybody that I did. I tried to change it just to Ashley. Oh.
So when you go into a role like that in which you're going on to a show that's been pumping out episodes for a couple of years now, I mean, you've not only done that with Dawson Creek, you've done that with NCIS Los Angeles, CSI, CSI Miami, Nip Tuck.
So many. So, Desperate Housewives, so many parts. I've come in when the cast is already established.
What's that experience like going into an environment in which they already have kind of like an organization developed to where they're pumping out these episodes, but yet you are bringing something new to the table?
I mean, so far, all of my experiences have been really great. There's something about those shows that's been on for so long that they just have a system. So everything is worked out. You come on, they know exactly where to take you. Sometimes on the newer shows, there's trying to work out like how they run it. So I actually love coming on shows that are well established.
Is that something that you may have been hesitant to try at first because of the desire to want to find more recurring roles? Or is it just like, this is a job I can take for a good payday for a day. I'm just going to take what I can get.
Well, here's the thing. When you're starting out, you're just lucky to get an audition. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like you go in and you're, you know, going up for these parts that are just, you know, one day guest star or guest star. Mm-hmm. And you got to get experience under your belt. So if anybody's out there and they're listening, you have to get credits underneath you or you don't build up. No one rarely gets like a series regular part on their first try. Usually it's years before they get that.
What about like a recurring role like you had on True Blood in which you were doing more than one episode of the same show, but you're still like, for lack of a better word, background character just for more than one episode?
Yeah, I mean, for those two, they pay you the same. So when I went and did True Blood, I had a lot of dialogue and then the cast is so big that they cut it down. So mm-hmm. when I shoot something, especially reoccurring parts, you don't know what's going to end up on screen. So of course you take a job for True Blood. It's one of the top shows at the time. I was like, so grateful for that part. But when it's on screen, you never know. I mean, there's that famous story about Vince Vaughn got a part and he told everybody about it and then he got cut out? Or was that Matt Damon? Somebody, that happens all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, even getting a reoccurring part's really difficult. That takes a while to move up to that. So, you know, you start out as a day player, a co-star, and then you move up to a one-day guest star and then a guest star. That's just how it is in the business.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to ask you about your experience on True Blood, because not only was I a huge fan of that show, watched every episode, I've also visited the set on Warner Brothers Studios when I did a tour of the studio with my wife. We were on the set for the exterior shots from Merlot's. And when you're going into something like that, like when you booked the True Blood gig, did you know how many episodes that you would be doing? Or is it just like, we want you to do this one character, maybe we'll make the decision to bring you back to do more?
Well, with True Blood, that one was really up in the air. When I went in, I went and read with Carrie, and she was so amazing to read with, and they loved me right away, and I pretty much got the part in the room. It said reoccurring on it, but I didn't know how many episodes when I got it. And then other places, when you get reoccurring, they're like 5 out of 7. You know, 7 episodes, or it's in the contract. But a lot of shows keep it up in the air.
When you're doing shows like that, especially ones like on HBO or Showtime, like you were on an episode of Masters of Sex, is the pressure there to want to do things that maybe aren't in your comfort zone for the sake of getting the gig, i.e. like nudity? Because, I mean, I can imagine, well, I can only imagine that as somebody in your position who's trying to get work but is also viewed as this incredibly beautiful woman, that the people that are getting these castings are going to try to take any liberty that they can to get you to do whatever it is that they want you to do. But you still have to, you know, I'm not sure how I want to word this, but like you want the part, but how much are you willing to sacrifice for it? You know what I mean? Like, is that something that, like, you got comfortable with right away? Or is that something that you had to kind of be, like, coerced into? Or what was that like for you?
No one's ever coerced me into anything. I think when I was younger, I was definitely okay with, like, topless nudity a little bit. Mm-hmm. Especially if, like, Sam Mendes comes along and asks you, loves you, you go in for the audition, and then tells you that's part of the... there's like a sex scene with Jake Gyllenhaal. I'm like, sign me up for that. You know, like I will, you don't even have to pay me. I'll do that part. So yeah, for certain gigs, it's kind of goes with the character, but have I had people, you know, I take a role and I sign a contract and then later down the line, they've asked, you know, will she, you know, in the sex scene, just show her side butt or something? I have to say no, because I'm not interested. First of all, that was never in the contract and I didn't agree to that. And second of all, that is not necessary to tell the story. So I don't have a problem with nudity if it helps tell the story. If it's just nudity for nudity's sakes, then I'm not interested in it.
Do you think that that has ever... I mean, have you ever turned down an opportunity for a job because of that? Do you think that that's had any type of effect on future opportunities because of your lack of desire to do it for nudity's sake?
I'm sure. I mean, I've said no to big parts. But here's the thing. It's like when I see the part, I'm always glad I said no. And there's something about, I have done a role before for money. It was really, really good money. And I wasn't that excited about the part. It wasn't like a stretch. And I didn't feel like, listen, sometimes you just take a job because you need the money or you need health insurance. And it's work becomes work, you know? So I have had a job where I did a part out of town on location for a while that there was a scene I wasn't excited about. And when the day came, I wanted to bail. Like I called my husband and was like, I don't want to shoot it. I don't want to be here. And unfortunately I already signed the contract. So I had to, you know, be a professional and do my job. But after that day, I think it was like 8 years ago, I said, I'm never doing that again. If I ever feel uncomfortable while reading a script, you know, on the day you're going to be really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Were you uncomfortable the day that you did that scene with Jake? I'm assuming that's in Jarhead that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. No, there's something about when I'm on set, I don't feel like myself. I don't know if it's I just kind of disconnect, not completely, but when I
slip into the character.
Yeah, I slip into the character, so it's not me. It doesn't feel like me. And then when we're done shooting, I feel like myself again. And then when I watch it on screen, I don't see myself. I actually see the character.
What was it like to do that with Jake? Like, did you spend some time with him prior to doing that for comfort's sake? Or were you just like, the what you see on camera is what you shot?
Well, here's the funny thing. I write about it in the book.
Okay.
Because my book has to do with Hollywood and my mm-hmm. addiction of sex and love addiction. And I put it together in this novel, and it's a fictional character. But I talk about a scene that, you know, it's kind of based on Jarhead a little bit. But I call it, they always put naked scenes or love scenes on the first day. And you're like, Sam Mendes called it naked day. Like, everybody got naked somehow that day. All the guys had the shower scene together. We had our love scene. Then somebody else, Marty Papazian, had his scene with his girlfriend, that the video or something that was in there. So it was like naked day for everybody. Everybody got semi-naked. And I kept thinking, why are they doing this on the first day? And then I realized every movie and show, they always put love scenes first. And I think because they want to make sure the actors don't back out. And then I think it's just to like get it done. So when you see love scenes, usually those are on the first day. And it's hi, nice to meet you, nice to meet you. Okay, don't touch my boobs. Okay, don't touch me here. Okay, let's do this. Like, that's how it is.
Interesting.
Very like technical. You just like cut to the chase, and there's no like getting to know each other or anything.
Well, you mentioned your love and sex addiction, and that was one of the things that really triggered me to wanting to talk to you about this, because mental health awareness is something that I've been diving a lot into on my show. I've had mental health professionals on here before, and I've talked about mm-hmm. my own journey, which I will elaborate a little, you know, further when I get the chance to do your show.
And I know, I'm excited.
I've also had, I haven't released it yet, but I've recorded an episode just focused on addiction and sobriety because, I mean, as we're recording this today, yesterday I'm 7 years sober from drinking alcohol.
Yay, and congratulations, happy birthday.
Thank you. So when it comes to addiction, and again, I dive into this a lot more in the episode in which I had a mental health professional worker on the show, it takes a lot of different forms. And for you, it was love and sex. And when I'm thinking of the two types of addiction, like, what to you separates love addiction from sex addiction? Because when I was talking about this with a friend of mine, mm-hmm. they didn't know that there was such a thing as love addiction. And like, in my mind, I have an idea of what it is, but I'd rather you define it for me, since that was something that you lived through.
Yeah, no, I just had my birthday too, December 6th, for 11 years.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, which is, I guess, like, I'm an old timer in Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, which we call SLAW. So if you're listening, I'm going to say SLAW. That's what I mean. Yes, here's the whole thing. I like to break it down. Sex and love addiction is we're addicted to people. So imagine people are addicted to alcohol or drugs. We're addicted to people and our interactions with people. So sex addiction, it's, you know, having sex with one night stands, which is not my thing. Having, you know, buying sex, porn, masturbation. It's this compulsion that when you feel a feeling, you want to release, and how you do that is through sexual acts. And love addiction is really based in fantasy and romance and relationships. And it's, you know, dating unavailable people, dating a bunch of people, you know. Also, sex addiction and love addiction is cheating. You're like in a relationship, but then you're outside intriguing or flirting outside of your relationship. And love is very about fantasy, like this, making this person everything, and you're so codependent, you can't let them go. So for me, it's a very combination. It's, I attach it to power and control over another human being. And that is the same thing for most sex and love addicts. And they say most men are sex addicts and most women are love addicts, but I have to disagree. I mean, in my meetings, 50-50, there's women that are sex and love addicts and sex addicts, and men that are both. I know a ton of men that are just love addicts. So it's plaguing our society right now. They say, you know, there's 6 million people right now in the United States that have this addiction. And that's just people that say they have this addiction. Mm-hmm. And 38% of them are women. And I think most of them, half of them at least, are women.
Do you think that that's something that may not be taken as seriously, a woman who is suffering from sex addiction?
Oh, for sure, 100%. Because when I first got in the program, I didn't really tell that many people. And when I did, there was like a confusion sometimes. And then there was also like people thought I was attractive. And I would say there's nothing attractive or hot about using somebody else to fill your emptiness. So it's educating people for me right now. It's being of service to people that don't know they have this disease. And if you're listening right now and you're like, wait, I keep going back to that unavailable person that never shows up for me, or I find myself cheating on my partner and I feel like I have so many girlfriends or boyfriends or whoever, they have a self-diagnosed questionnaire online. It's 40 questions. You can go on and answer it. It's under Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous and see what you get. They say if you get more than 5 yeses, it's probably something you should look into.
Yeah, because I mentioned this in the episode that I'm yet to air, but I'll tell you this. There was a time in which, after my wife had passed away, that I thought that I was struggling with some sex addiction. And I looked into the possibility of meeting up with a group, just basically to kind of, I wanted to use it as a barometer to judge just where I was on the spectrum of addiction and whether or not it was something that I was truly struggling with or if it was just something that I was just in my own head about. And it ultimately ended up not facilitating into anything. I ended up going into this meeting 15 minutes in before I realized it's a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. It was supposed to take place in the same venue, but apparently I was in the wrong room or something.
There's different rooms usually.
Well, and when I started talking to some of the people that were there, I mean, I kind of had an idea of what I was walking into and it being not what I wanted to walk into almost right away, just because of the literature that was there and the people that you see coming in. I mean, I'm not trying to like stereotype or categorize what a sex and love addict looks like versus what a narcotics addict looks like. I'm just saying, like, they don't normally bus in from the local penitentiary, people who are suffering from love and sex addiction.
Sometimes, sometimes they do. I mean, honestly, when my first meeting I walked into, it was 40 people, and it was every walk of life, every diversity, everything you can imagine. It could be a janitor to an A-list star to a meth addict that just got off meth. It's literally the most diverse group I have ever been a part of.
Well, where I was going with that was the guy that I was talking to outside before the meeting had actually started, I had told him that I was there for a different reason. And I eventually said, you know, I was kind of trying to judge whether or not I was a sex addict. And he had said, well, just because we're here for something else doesn't mean that you can't take all the stuff that we talk about and apply it to your addiction. And like that,
totally.
That was like the smartest thing that he could have said to me, because even though I didn't stay, I still remember that and thinking like, okay, so it really doesn't matter what your addiction is. There's methodologies out there available for people to overcome whatever it is that you're addicted to. So when you decided that you wanted to seek that help for yourself, like what triggered you to make you think that this was something that was a problem that needed to be addressed? Was it like something specific that had happened, or was it like you kind of going through all of the behavioral patterns that you were exhibiting and thinking like there's a pattern here that I don't like? What was the moment for
my
you?
My wake up?
Yeah, yeah.
I have no problem. I mean, some of the stories are in the book, but there was this one moment in my life where I thought, you know, me using people or having a bunch of boyfriends or flirting a lot or, you know, having a lot of guy friends and leading people on and, you know, going on location and flirting with my co-stars, things like that, I thought I grew out of. I thought it was just because I was in my 20s, and that's what people do when they date a lot of people. But I found myself with my boyfriend, and one day our mentor died, and I found myself 2 days later on location shooting a movie, and I was about to, you know, blow up my relationship. I was about to, you know, start intriguing, and I was sitting in the hotel room in my dark room, and I said, oh my God, I thought that was just a stage in my life, like, I'm about to do it again. And here's somebody I'm with that I love, that I care about, that I if I wasn't with him, I'd want to be his best friend, you know? And I just was like, wow, it can't be all these guys. It can't be all these people that aren't the perfect fit, or I was with them for a year and then the butterflies went away. So that means the relationship is over and we were done falling in love because I was addicted to falling in love. It can't be those things anymore. The common denominator is me. And I just had this vision. Am I going to be doing this the rest of my life? Am I always going to be searching? Am I going to be swiping left and right and left and right to find that person to fulfill me or my soulmate, which I think is all bullshit. Yeah. And so it really hit me. Like, I don't want to be doing this when I'm 65 years old. Like, that's not cute. Mm-hmm. I could get away with it maybe in my 20s, but now that I think about it, it's like how many people I've used to like give me attention so I feel important is disgusting. So I called a therapist that a friend recommended. And one of our first sessions, she says, you're a sex and love addict. And I was like, oh, what? And I remember she told me this funny thing. And at first it really pissed me off. Of course, she looked at me and she said, you wear the mask of like a high class prostitute. Like it feels like you can't penetrate you. Like there's like no, and I was angry at first. And then I thought, oh my God, I have been wearing a mask and I'm an actress also. So it's like, I'm acting while I'm acting as a person. And I just realized I was so disconnected from everyone in my life, my boyfriend, my friends, my family. There was always a part of me with one foot out the door because I was scared of being fear of abandonment, fear of being loved, fear of self-worth, and all that was based on I was empty inside. So that was the moment I was like, wow, I filled out the questions. I'm not going to say how many I got. Yes, you have to read the book. But yeah, I filled out the questions and it was very obvious I had this problem. It was things like, do you find yourself attracted to unavailable people? Do you find yourself being sexual when you don't want to be sexual? Do you find yourself cheating on your partner? It's tons of questions. So yeah, it was a moment for me where I made a decision, like I need to get help and I have to do it for me. And I will tell you today, you know, that boyfriend is now my husband. We've been together for 16 years. It's not like I got better in the program and then I found my perfect partner. And my husband doesn't fill me and nobody fills me. I actually fill myself. So it's the best feeling in the world.
What was your relationship with him like when you decided that that was something that you wanted to get help with? I mean, I assume that, you know, because you're married to him, that he was very supportive. But was there any point in which like he tried to, I don't want to use the word trick, but basically convince you that your problem is not as big as you think it is because you two were together?
No. I got very lucky. And it's not a normal story. So don't think everybody has this story in the program. But we were together for a while and he always felt like a part of my foot was out the door, even though we lived together and, you know, we had dogs together and everything. It's not like I wasn't trying to be connected. I just didn't have the tools to completely be connected because my parents' marriage was very unstable. And I never saw a loving marriage. I never saw a marriage. It was always drama. And I didn't realize marriage, yes, it's difficult, but there's not supposed to be drama, mm-hmm. you know? So for him, I got lucky. He was already in a 12-step program, and I'm not breaking his anonymity. He would tell you. He's 32 years sober in AA today. And
oh, that's great.
So he understood 12-step programs. And when I called him, it was funny. I called him after that therapy session. I was driving on the 101 in traffic, and I was bawling my eyes out. And I was like, she says I'm a sex and love addict, like hysterically crying in the car. And I got home, and he printed all the meetings in Los Angeles, and he highlighted all the ones I could go to.
That's great.
And I found myself that night at a meeting for newcomers. And like I said, there was 40 people from all walks of life and all of them were telling my story. And I started crying again, which I'm not a person that cries in public. I'm very like, you can't break me. So I was like crying in the corner but I was crying because I realized I wasn't alone and I wasn't broken and I wasn't missing that gene that just couldn't fully commit to another person. I just didn't have the tools. So for that first year of my program and my sobriety, I had 9 months of horrible withdrawal, like crawling on the carpet, crying every day. And my husband and I, who was my boyfriend, we had a rule. He wasn't allowed to come fix me or like comfort me. If I was crying in the bedroom, I had to go through it. And that first year we didn't have sex because I didn't realize I didn't have that part of myself. So how can I give it away to anybody else if every time I gave it away, I was never truly present? So it was hard. I'm not going to lie. And we both made an agreement for me to get healthy was to break up our relationship, then we were both willing to let that go. So there was this willingness to allow me to grow, and he worked his program, and somehow we kept it together. And we only spent one night apart our entire relationship. So
wow.
I'm very grateful. He's a wonderful partner, and he, you know, went through a lot with me. But here's the thing. That's the beauty of life. Like, I always thought, ew, being with one person your whole life, how boring. You know, and I'm not allowed to flirt or intrigue with people. I can't even flirt with the guy giving me a coffee at Starbucks. Like, flirting's so, like, harmless. And I realized, no, flirting is actually really dangerous. First of all, you're letting off this energy that the other person, you're like raping each other of your energy. And I didn't realize how much energy I was just throwing away to random people so they could then bounce it back to me so I would feel like a jolt of something.
Right. It's almost as if like you're playing this dangerous game in which you're kind of tiptoeing over whatever you think your boundaries are, but you don't know what their perception of your boundaries are. And as you get a little bit closer and closer to that edge, and the endorphins kind of start kicking in, and you realize, oh, shit, I actually met my threshold 5 steps ago. We're in uncharted waters here, and I'm kind of past like a point of no return. And I've been there myself.
Yeah. And there's the thing, once you do that, then those endorphins go away. And when you do it the next time, it gets less and less. So you have to keep amplifying your actions to get that same hit from somebody, you know, a stranger, which is crazy if you think about it.
Right. Well, especially today.
Yeah. Especially like DMing. I can't tell you how many of my girlfriends are addicted to DMing strangers on Instagram. It is insane. And I look at them and I'm like, what are you getting from this? And one of them got really addicted to this guy, and she lost her sobriety in AA, which is, she had 8 years over a random dude in like Arizona that she's never met. And I was like, you don't even know him. And she's like, we've talked. I'm like, he could be anybody. Like, right. Why are you letting this person you don't know affect your life when you're not even being honest about who you are?
Well, like you said, they're filling a void that they're otherwise not able to fill themselves. They're
exactly.
They're putting themselves out there for the sake of the attention in which they gravitate to when they normally don't get that themselves. And that's where I think the difference is between love and sex addiction is because one can be a lot more physical, whereas one is a lot more emotional, but there's still a control factor involved.
It's a control and power. It's a control and power over other people. And listen, you know, I sometimes think the sex addictions part is easier to get over than the love addiction part. Because
getting over
a mental connection that's false or not or manipulative is 10 times harder than getting over that sexual hit. And that for me wasn't. The sex was just like whatever. It was the buildup to like that sex or intimacy. That's what I chased, the high from the chase. But I did remember this moment very clearly when I was getting my 6 month chip. This newcomer came in and he said, I could quit meth, but I cannot quit her. And that to me was such a moment where I was like, oh, this is no joke. And I knew it was no joke because I went through withdrawal, but that was like a big revelation. And then I also had this other moment where I've been speaking at a lot of jails, not right now during the pandemic, but I spoke at a lot of female jails in Los Angeles for two and a half years. And every woman in the jail was in for sex and love addiction. They either killed somebody, robbed somebody for a guy or their partner, you know, like every woman. And the meetings were so large in the prison, and it hit me how deadly this disease is. More people are murdered and, you know, taken advantage of over sex and love addiction than any other addiction.
I totally agree. I see what you're saying now, and, mm-hmm. and it's such a clearer answer to me than had you not just said that.
Well, look at any Dateline. Mm-hmm. Watch a Dateline. Everyone is because someone is cheating. There's a love triangle. You know, they want the money, but usually they have someone on the side they want to be with. Every single Dateline is almost a sex and love addict.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, they want to get out of their reality. They're trying to, you know, create a different life. They have different personas. I mean, just watch a Dateline. DM me if you don't agree.
Well, you had mentioned the first time that you went to a group and that inclusivity that you felt that you were not alone. Is that kind of like the inspiration as to why you wanted to start your Secret Life podcast?
Totally. Ding, ding, ding. Nail on the head. Yes.
See what I did there?
Yeah, you're so smart. Yeah, because during the pandemic, my husband and I, we have a ton of 12-step meetings. I go to one every day. I go to more meetings now and, you know, this last couple of years than I did when I started. I go to a meeting a day and my husband does too. And we were just seeing how many people are struggling right now. They're very lonely. Everything's coming to the surface because we don't have anything to push it down. You can't go shopping because you got nowhere to go. You know, you can't get out of the house because everything is closed. You
can't go to the bar.
Can't go to the bar and have a drink. You can't, you know, we've stripped away everything. So everything is rising to the surface. And I wrote an article for HuffPost pretty much outing myself, which I never wanted to do. I did it on my 10 years I got in the program. I felt this need to like be of service bigger than just my community. And I started sponsoring people around the world. So I wrote this article for HuffPost outing myself, and it got 2 million hits that first month. And
oh, wow.
I had so many people reach out to me, men and women, saying, that is my story, that is my husband, that is my girlfriend, whatever. And after a couple of months in the pandemic, I woke up and I was like, Secret Life. Other people tell me their secrets and I'll still tell mine. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell anybody I was doing it. My husband's like, let's just get a mic. And I asked a friend of mine to be my first guinea pig. And then I did Mark's, my husband's interview, and I loved it. And it's just been such a way to be of service because it's not about me or the guests. It's about the people that don't have a voice. It's the listeners. It's the voiceless. And mm-hmm. I just want people to know they're not alone. And we all struggle. We all struggle with like fear of not being enough. We all hold in things we shouldn't because secrets really kill us. And that is what my message is once you let go, because the day HuffPost came out, I thought the world was going to stop. Like literally. I woke up that morning, like, what am I doing? Everything is over. People are going to freak out. Nothing happened.
I can only imagine the anxiety that I would feel to allow myself to be that vulnerable on that level.
Yeah. But I thought the world, like, everybody was going to call me. And nothing happened. I was like, oh, my God, get over yourself. You're, like, such a small part of this universe. Nobody cares, Brianne. Like, get over yourself. Like, so it was such a humbling moment for me and growth. And it also let me release any last shame of being a sex and love addict. I already had a decade of recovery. I've worked on my stuff. I've taken responsibility for my amends I had to make to people. I make a living amends never to hurt another soul. And I'm of service. So I don't have any shame about my addiction. I'm a grateful sex and love addict. But there's something about writing about it and putting it out into the world. But it just let me let go of any last shame or secret or anything, just evaporate. And it was such a freeing moment for me that I want to give other people that moment. And we released 32 episodes and I have 92 recorded still.
Whoa.
So we have enough for 2.5 years.
That's amazing.
We're just going to keep being of service. And I'm still getting episodes. You know, I'm recording yours. And mm-hmm. It's like I'm still getting some people's. And it's such a way for me to be of service and to give back.
You talked about the show being kind of like an open forum to be basically a confessional.
Yes.
And
completely.
So what kind of, without, you know, outing anybody specifically, but like what kind of confessions have people come to you with that stand out, blew your mind, something that you couldn't even have imagined people would be coming to you with as a result of you having the show and this platform for them to unburden themselves of these secrets that they live?
Well, there was a couple that really shook me. One of them really shook me was one of the first ones I got from I do a lot of anonymous people come on and they just give me like their first name and I don't see their faces. And mm-hmm. sometimes I don't even get their real name. And then I get to have a lot of friends or well-known people that I have too. But one came on, she heard Kristen's episode where she shot herself in the chest with a shotgun in her car, committing suicide because she was never perfect enough. And she talked me through the moment after she shot herself. And I think it was like episode 6 or 7. And I'm telling you, I was holding back how much like I wanted to cry. But I didn't want to inhibit her telling her story.
Right.
So that was a really beautiful moment. And we're friends till this day. And I adore her. She's like an advocate for suicide now. And I just think she's going to do amazing things. And another one that really shook me was an anonymous one. No one will ever know who it is. And she said that she, and some of them I don't know beforehand, just so you know, but she mm-hmm. said that she used abortions as a form of birth control.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's
so she
rough.
Walked, yeah. That one was really rough to hear.
Yeah.
So that one was tough, but I mean, I have so many beautiful ones where, you know, somebody, you know, was wanting to attempt suicide after he got cancer and he got submitted to an institution in Sale Asylum for like 10 days. And he walked me through how that was. And he's not total living soul. Then I have a cutter one coming out that's pretty brutal. You know, a lot of eating disorders, men and women, a lot of addiction. Obviously, I talk about my addiction. But you want to know the hardest one I have not been able to get yet?
Sure.
I'm shocked. I cannot find any men that will come on and say they're a sex and love addict and give me the examples. I have one coming out that, you know, he was addicted to massage parlors and another one addicted to a relationship. But there's something about men right now. I thought I would have a lot more time. I thought that would be an easy one to get, but that's the one I've been struggling. I've asked some of my friends I'm good friends with. They all said no. Yeah, I just think men don't want to talk about it.
I mean, I'll talk about it with you for a second just because.
Yeah.
Even though.
Wait, this is not my show, though.
No. I'm
too much.
No, I mean, when we go to do your show, it's going to be a lot more about my struggles with suicidal thoughts in the wake of my wife's death. But like, since I was kind of alluding to it a little bit earlier, I mean, I don't necessarily believe that I was a love and sex addiction. If I was, then I was very easily able to drop it because mm-hmm. there was a void, a very noticeable void that I was trying to fill constantly with massage parlors and with women that I've met on Tinder and with women that I've met online mm-hmm. that I was trying to fulfill a void that was very noticeably there after my wife passed away, but it was easy to do in such a fleeting way because I wasn't ready to make any type of emotional connection with anybody yet.
That makes sense.
I wasn't at a place where I had even started the process of dealing with how my wife's death affected me and all the events that transpired between me and her leading up to her death had affected me, but right. I still felt this insatiable thirst for connection, for intimacy, both mm-hmm. physically and I mean, like I said, it's fleeting, and that's why I had done it so many times, but it was because of this void that I felt, and that's why I was trying to use going to a meeting as a barometer to measure whether or not I was actually an addict or this was just a phase.
Do you think, though, you whack-a-moled it? Do you feel like that has transferred to somewhere else? Because sometimes, like,
I have a very addictive personality.
Yeah, so that could have happened because sometimes there's, when trauma happens, that's when our addict comes out, mm-hmm. that we don't know how to deal with the feelings we're feeling and the loss or all that comes up. So we project, like, go and do massage parlors or all that stuff. And sometimes when we realize, oh, this might be a problem, it whack-a-moles to another area. We start overeating or not eating, or we start shopping, or we start gambling, or we start, you know, like, it can literally whack-a-moles to a bunch of different places.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can necessarily identify a place that I've kind of transferred that type of attention. Mm-hmm. Maybe this podcast a little bit.
Maybe.
But throughout my journey with my doctor, I mean, I went a solid year after my wife passed away before I sought help, because I thought that I had all my shit handled. And it turned out that I didn't. And
yeah. So you went to therapy.
I've been in therapy for over years now. For, well, it's less often now, but I still go at least twice a month.
Listen, I was doing therapy twice a week and doing the meetings. But another friend of mine who I have on the show, she is a sex and love addict, but 12 steps didn't work for her. And she's done the therapy route. I'm not saying every sex and love addict has to be in a 12-step program. It's just as long as you're working through the reasons you don't feel those feelings and the things you do, especially when you don't want to do it. If you're like, I don't know why I keep doing this. I don't want to do it, but a part of me can't stop, or it makes me feel better for a little bit, or, you know, that stuff. There's a way to get out of your addicted habits through therapy, through groups, smaller groups that aren't 12-step based. There's so many options if you're struggling out there.
Well, right. And that's kind of where I had covered a little bit of this in my mental health awareness episode of my show, in which I talked about my inability to identify what I was feeling during those times. Because I had told these stories over and over and over again. And when it comes to, like, you know, the parlors and the women and all that, I would tell that to people who I know would enable me, because then I wouldn't have to feel shame about it.
Right.
But it wasn't until I started telling these stories and my therapist basically, like, almost forced me to start attaching feeling words to what I was saying, so that the story is not just a story, it's something that I lived through and felt. And it wasn't until I started doing that I really had the ability and gave myself the opportunity to process what I was doing and how I felt about it while I was doing it and afterwards. And it was
But you had professional help.
Yes.
You need professional help to do that, because most of the time people do things and they have no idea why they keep doing them. You just are like, I don't feel good. Or it's the same thing they always do, but they don't understand why they're doing it and what they're feeling and what they're stuffing down.
Right.
So you got that. You did the work to actually have that conversation with yourself.
Well, I mean, my therapist helped me have that conversation, because I was suppressing the need to have it.
Yeah, completely. Like we all do. And if you have an addictive personality, we don't want to feel feelings. The only feeling I am interested in is euphoria. Yeah. Anything else I don't want to feel.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily think I was addicted to it, but I was definitely craving that feeling so that I could disconnect from all the things that I wasn't emotionally sifting through. Because of everything that had gone on with, you know, the passing of my wife and everything like that, I was using that as an escape. And that was me whack-a-moling my emotions from diverting away from how I felt as a result of my wife and her death and everything leading up to that, and putting it toward this other thing that I can still feel shame about, but I can convince myself of the lie that I'm not hurting anyone.
Yeah, I love that lie. Don't you love that lie? That's what I really found out. People are like, but I'm not hurting anyone. I'm not. And you're like, yeah, you do. Everything you do to another person, it ripples. There's a ripple effect. Mm-hmm. It will affect their next relationship or their it literally ripples.
Yeah.
But I love that lie when they're like, I'm not hurting anyone going to this massage parlor. And it's like, you actually don't know that.
Right.
Sorry, you don't know the woman that's giving you the massage. You don't know if that one night stand you just picked up in a bar, what she's going through, and you don't know who she's going to affect. There is a ripple effect for us using other people.
Yeah, because I've said it plenty of times, in which I think the two things that therapy has helped me the most with is, one, being able to identify my own feelings about things instead of talking about how I think, talking about how I feel. And the second thing is empathy, being able to, instead of just waiting for somebody to finish speaking so that I can take my turn to speak, actually listening to what they're saying and empathize with them and put myself in their shoes for a change.
oh, that's the key to success in life is being empathetic to other people and to yourself. Listen, we all make mistakes. We're all flawed. And the best thing you can do is have, you know, compassion and empathy and understand that everybody's going through something. They might look like they're not on the outside, but I will tell you, every single person I know on Instagram with millions of followers or, you know, huge stars that I know, everybody is going through something and their life is not perfect. So having empathy is the key for your own serenity and peace.
Yeah. And also being able to identify that, like, everybody is always the hero of their own story when they're telling it from their own perspective. You know what I mean? And being able to take an objective look at yourself, I think, is the key to self-improvement.
Completely. You have to look at yourself. You have to look at your you have to look at what you do, what your part is in the situation and relationship role you play, and to really see that and work on it. Because if not, you're going to be doing the same thing with different people over and over again. And that's what I used to say. You could literally put somebody in front of me and put a bag over their head. It didn't really matter who they were. It's what they mirrored back to me.
Right. Before I let you go, I want to talk about your book for a minute.
Again,
it's A Secret Life of a Hollywood Sex and Love Addict, a novel, which is about a character named Roxanne.
Yes.
Why, and I'm sure you're probably going to get asked this question a lot, why would you choose to go with a novel approach as opposed with an autobiographical approach? Because obviously, through this conversation that we've been having, a lot of the tales that your character goes through are based on your own personal experience.
Correct. I would say 60% of it is my own personal experience when you read it. First of all, I wrote it as a memoir. I wrote it in 45 days, the first draft. So it just spilled out of me. And listen, I never wanted to write a book, like I said. I never wanted to come out, but I was coerced by my husband because he loves to do that. He loves to dare me to do something, and then I do it, and I'm like, eh. But anyways.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
There's not. He's very supportive and very kind, and he sees the good in me before I do most of the time. So I'm very grateful for that. But it was a memoir. And when I was working on it, all these dreams and stories and parts of other people's stories were popping into my head. And I just started writing them down, and I realized this is just bigger than my story. This is universal. You could pick it up and identify with some things. And I just organically became her story. And I couldn't think of her name. And I was like, what is her name? And all of a sudden the song from The Police, Roxanne, popped in on the radio. And I was like, oh my God, that's her name. And the good thing about writing a novel is no one can sue you. So a lot of stories are about Hollywood, are about my experiences, but you'll never know who they are. I've changed all the names. And, you know, chapter 5, 6, and 7 were the hardest chapters for me to write. They were really tough to write. Every time I got to them, I wanted to throw up or throw the book against the wall. But it was just a way for me to put my creativity in storytelling with my life experience. And it really just turned out, I'm so proud of it and proud of her journey, Roxanne's journey. And I just feel like she's a part of me, but she's a part of so many other people. And I say that at the end of the book, I say, listen, this could be your mom, your sister, your cousin, your girlfriend. Like, we can all be a little bit of Roxanne. So,
Were there parts in which you were writing the book in which you kind of struggled with, like, if I take too much creative liberty with this character, it may diminish the importance of the story that I'm trying to tell, especially through the perspective of my own experiences? Like, did you struggle with that at all?
No. I just really trusted that whatever was supposed to come out on the page was meant to be there. And I let it, any preconceived notions of what I thought it would look like, because I didn't have any preconceived notions because I never wanted to write it. Joke's on me. But yeah, it just organically came out. And honestly, a lot of the things I added were other people's little
innuendos.
Yes, their little things that added to understanding the disease more. Because here's the main thing, when I got done with the book, I realized when I started my recovery in sex and love addiction, every book I picked up was so educational and so doctor written that I would get through a page of it and be like, ugh, and literally throw it against the wall. I threw like three of those like books against the wall because it was just too down your throat educational and like technical, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm an entertainer. So when I started writing, I really wrote it in to be entertained. Anybody can pick it up. Somebody that doesn't understand the addiction or have an addictive personality, a normie is what we call them, will be entertained by this book and it will help them understand sex and love addiction so much more. And that's my goal, is to entertain, but also to educate without it being beaten down someone's throat.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Thanks.
Because like when I eventually sit down to write the story of my journey, which is going to have a lot of personal experience and perspectivism from everything that I went through with the trauma and the recovery and all that stuff, I feel like there would be parts of the story that I would want to tell based on what I've learned via sharing my story with other people and hearing their stories in return that I would want to include, because not my journey is not going to mirror anyone else's. But yeah, they can take little bits and pieces from it and provide their own little experiences and perspective and really kind of encompass what it is that you're going through without having to worry about doing yourself, the story, or the people that read it a disservice.
Yeah, that's why I decided to do Aroma Club Fiction, because it's based on your life, but you can exaggerate it a little bit. And it just gave me the freedom to actually tell more of my dark secrets. Because when it was just me and my memoir, it was just, it felt too like, first of all, I could probably get sued. And second of all, like, I just felt too much pressure for like my journey to be enough, I guess, even though it is enough. But there's something about like when you don't make it a memoir, that you make it a Roma Clef fiction, where you can even go deeper because there's not so much pressure. And it just really allowed me to let go of that last layer of, I guess, if that teeny little bit of shame, or I just literally, it evaporated after I wrote it.
That's great. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. I actually pre-ordered the book. By the time this airs, I probably will have already read it. And I'm looking forward to actually reading it, because not just because we were going to chat here today, but because, like I said, my desire to talk to you had a lot to do with the Secret Life podcast and the book that you have that's available now, because like you said, we're all going through something. And I love the fact that we can have platforms and conversations now to bring this stuff to life, to light, so that we don't have to feel shame about being flawed.
Exactly. And that's my whole goal. And I'll be on that bandwagon with you. Like, let's bring all the shit and the darkness and the shame and the secrets. Let's just put it all out there, because there's something when you do that, that it just like opens the door for healing.
It's so freeing. It is so freeing.
Oh my God. It's the best. It's like the best high in the world.
Yeah.
If anything, if my,
maybe that's what I whack-a-mole to.
Maybe, because honestly, that's the one thing that always gets out of me out of myself is being of service and connecting to you or my guests or one of my sponsees or my sponsor. It's like, that's where the healing is, when we connect to one other person and we're authentic and we're raw and we're open and we're our honest selves.
I think that's the perfect place to end this interview. The Secret Life podcast is available anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also follow Breanne on Instagram at Breanne Davis. You're constantly updating with what's going on with that.
Yeah.
And the book is Secret Life of a Hollywood Sex and Love Addict, a novel. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks so much. It was such a great conversation.
Oh, I love that you said that. All right. Take care.
You too.
Regular listeners of this show know that I don't do this show just so I can sell out, that I wouldn't endorse a product that I didn't believe in, that I like to highlight people from my hometown that are doing amazing things. And that's why I'm happy to be sponsored in part by Rolling Acre, makers of CBD and CBG products from my hometown of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Rolling Acre Farm sits on 105 beautiful pesticide-free acres in Carlisle, where they grow high-quality hemp to produce superior-tasting CBD and CBG, unlike anything else you'll find on the market. I have a lot of problems falling and staying asleep at night, but since I started using Rolling Acres CBD and CBG before I go to bed, I noticed that while I'm not getting more sleep, I'm getting better sleep, more quality sleep, and I feel more rested when I wake up in the morning. Rolling Acres spends long days on their farm planting, nourishing, and harvesting their hemp by hand and processing it in a state-of-the-art lab right on the farm before it only leaves to be third-party tested for both quality and potency. Friend of the show Nate Blazer uses Rolling Acre for his gluten allergy, telling me that he notices improvement within 30 minutes of using it. And if you go to rolling-acre.com, you can learn more about the farm, shop their selections of 1,000-milligram full-spectrum CBD and CBG tinctures, and when you're ready to try it for yourself, you can use the promo code STRONGWORDS to get $10 off your next purchase. They even have two flavors that your dogs, cats, and horses will love. So again, go to rolling-acre.com, use the promo code STRONGWORDS at checkout, and receive $10 off your order. Available to ship in all 48 CBD and CBG legal states. You can find them on social media at Rolling Acre or go to rolling-acre.com today. Thanks so much again to Breanne Davis for coming on the show and sharing some of her stories with me, as well as her book. If you're interested in reading A Secret Life of a Hollywood Sex and Love Addict, a novel, you can find it on Kindle. You can also get it on Amazon or go to secretlifenovel.com. New episodes of her Secret Life podcast air every Monday on Apple Podcasts, or you can go to secretlifepodcast.com, and you can find her on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Breanne Davis. And while you're giving her a follow and subscribing to her podcast, if you'd like to follow this podcast on social media, you can do so on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Ian Strong Words. Give me a follow there. I'll give you a follow back. That's how I do things. And if you could take the time to like, follow, subscribe, write me a review, leave me a rating, comment stars, all that stuff, I genuinely appreciate you taking the time to do so and helping to spread the strong words. And if you follow me at Ian Strong Words, you'll be the first to find out when I make my appearance on Breanne Davis's Secret Life podcast. But that'll do it for this episode of Strong Words with Ian Strong. Come back in 2 weeks as the hits just keep on coming, because for the first time since August, I'm getting the Fab Three back together. That's right, Marvel and DC comic book letterer extraordinaire and bass player for my band Dead Cowboy, Dave Sharp, is going to return to the show, as well as my best friend in the whole world, one half of Awesomely Strong, lead singer of Dead Cowboy, Captain Awesome himself, Mr. Dan Freit. The three of us have already tackled the world of The Walking Dead. We already had an uncanny discussion of all the films in the world of X-Men, and now it's time to have an amazing discussion of all the films in the world of Spider-Man. We'll let you know where we think all of the live-action films, as well as Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the very popular animated feature, rank on all of our respective lists. We'll discuss who of the three actors to portray Spider-Man and Peter Parker on the big screen we like the best and why, and so much more. So don't forget to check that out. 2 weeks from today, the Fab Three is getting back together to have an amazing discussion about the world of Spider-Man films. But, as I say every episode, oh wait, I'm not going to do that today, because I promised to make a really big announcement about a huge guest that I'm going to be having right here on the show, right here in the near future. And instead of having me tell you, I'm just going to let him tell you. Take us home.
Yo, it's me, DDP, Diamond Dallas Page, the king of Bada Bing, the master of the diamond cutter, the three-time world champion, WWE Hall of Famer, and founder and CEO of DDP Yoga, better known today as DDPY. Why? I'll tell you why. Because I want people to stop calling it just effing yoga. That's why. And I want you to know that May 10th, I will be on Strong Words with my buddy, the man with a plan, Ian Strong. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. Bang!
Strong Words!